Yeah, it's nice to have you here. I really, really enjoyed. Now you see it. I'd like to talk about the novel and about your work and your background. And I guess it's kind of a primitive way to start, but I guess I should ask you how it all came about. What in your formative years would indicate that you would someday be a writer?
Oh, that's the thing I always wanted to be, actually. As a small child, I used to say I wanted to be an author. That's the word I used then. And I used to read a lot. Started writing when I was about 12, and seriously in high school, and finished my first novel in college.
Your first novel?
Yes.
I thought this was your first novel.
It was my first published novel.
First published novel. Oh, I see, yes. Yeah. Well, did you, your family, a literary background? What kind of family did you grow up in?
Not very literary. Actually, my father was a career naval officer and a captain in the Navy when he retired. And my mother was a teacher, English and music. I guess that's probably, she's the one. You got me started.
She probably encouraged you a lot.
Huh? Absolutely.
Where did you grow up?
All over the place because of the Navy. I was born in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and lived mostly in the Washington, D.C. area and San Francisco, where my family settled after my father died. They stayed in Marin County, California. They're still there.
Which I suppose is why you were able to write about Berkeley with such authority.
Yes. Huh? Well, I lived in Berkeley for 7 years, going to graduate school there.
Uh-huh. Where did you take your undergraduate degree?
University of California at Irvine.
English major?
English major with creative writing emphasis. It was the first one in the country, so I went down there to Southern California. Also, I wanted to be near the beach.
And you said you wrote your first novel in college. Was that your thesis or what?
I don't think I got credit for that as a thesis, actually, but I took creative writing classes and was writing fiction for those classes, but then I finished it on my own. I didn't turn the whole thing in for anything. In fact, I didn't show that novel to anyone. Yeah, it's still in a drawer.
Well, you could probably pick at it, make use of it somewhere along the line, can't you?
I don't know. That may be the right place for it.
I don't know. I know. Most of the writers I talk to hate to waste their words. In fact, I was talking to Malcolm Bossy, who wrote this novel, Mr. Touch. I was talking to him a while back. He was telling me that he went to Yale, and he was also writing. And he would write novels, and he would send them to a publisher, and they would be promptly rejected. So he would put these novels up in his closet, where they still are. And he made the assumption that because the publisher didn't like them, the novel was no good. He didn't know. I mean, he says he must have maybe half a dozen or a dozen unpublished novels that go way, way back, simply because somebody said, well, this novel is not for us, it's not very good, and Malcolm believed it. But actually, it's really a matter of opinion, isn't it? I was reading a very interesting article in the Publishers Weekly this week. I think it was the column called My Say. Do you ever read that? I'll photocopy it for you. But it's very interesting. It's about a woman who has published 20 novels and a lot of short stories. And when her material has been rejected, some of the editors who rejected the material would often put down comments like, this is too depressing, or the characters are not sympathetic. Or, you know, comments like that. And the point of this article was she didn't want to hear their opinions about it. If the novel was not for them, just say no and let her get on with the business of trying to merchandise her material. Does that make sense?
Well, sometimes you can learn a great deal from the comments of editors and readers. You find out how something comes across that you've done. I'm delighted to hear people's opinions. I love to talk about my book.
But you've had a lot of short stories published, haven't you?
Some, fair number, yeah.
Well, the short stories, weren't these the basis for Now You See It? Which is really a collection of short stories, not really a novel, is it?
Oh, it's really a novel. No,
it really is.
That's the way I thought of it. That's how I wrote it. I wrote it in short stories partly because I like the short story form very much, but I was always thinking of it as a novel. The I first started, I got interested in this form a long time ago, probably in high school, when I read Lawrence Durrell's Alexandria Quartet, which is four novels about that covers the same story, but each one has a different narrator, a different point of view on the same situation. And by the fourth one, your understanding of what happened in the first one is completely changed. Because the narrator of the first one really didn't understand the situation. And it corresponds to my sense of the shift in point of view like that, and the sense of partial knowledge from only one person's point of view really corresponds to my sense of what life is like, that we don't really understand our own experience fully, and you can't without seeing it from a lot of different points of view. So the idea of shifting points of view, which I did with these five different narrators in the seven stories, is exactly right for me in my sense of what life is like.
And yet I we can say parenthetically that each story from each different narrator can stand alone.
Absolutely, and most of them were published separately.
Where were they published?
Well, let's see. A couple of them were in prize competitions and won prizes and were published as part of that. One of them was published in the Nelson Algren Awards for Short Fiction in the Chicago Tribune. And others were in literary magazines, little literary magazines, which is where most of the really good new fiction in this country first appears, is in magazines most people have never heard of, but they should, like Plowshares, Quarterly West, Black Warrior Review, all three of which published parts of this book. They published short stories. They thought they were short stories. But
where does a reader get these magazines? You don't see them on the newsstand at the CBS building.
No, they're good bookstores will very often carry some literary magazines. Libraries, really good libraries, carry them. University libraries. But if you have to subscribe if you want to get them, far from urban centers.
Well, someone who really cares, I guess, would seek them out.
Mm. Yes, and you can find out about them if you're reading the best American short stories every year. It's a wonderful collection that comes out every year with 20 of what the current editor thinks are the 20 best short stories published that year. And you find out about literary magazines that way. They're listed in each one. It says what magazine it came from, and there's a whole list of literary magazines in the back.
Yeah, Richard Ford edited the past
year. Yeah.
Collection, and it's very interesting. They have these guest editors every year, along with Shannon Ravenel. I don't know if she is still
right. No,
working.
She is. Yeah.
Is she still working
mm-hmm.
on them?
Yeah,
sorry.
One of these stories was listed this year in their list of stories that she picked.
Well, it struck me as interesting that the guest editors have such divergent views. I remember when John Gardner was alive, he edited it one year, and he had sent his stories to the New Yorker for years and years and years, and they never bought any. And he got even with the New Yorker. When he was guest editor, he refused to take any New Yorker story. But I believe Richard Ford, on the other hand, I think he had three or four from the New Yorker.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's normal. They're usually three or four in every year. I mean, you think about it, they publish a short story every week of the year, 52 weeks out of the year. And plus, all the writers in the country send their work there first, or most of them, because it is... It's a good market, and so they get a lot of good fiction. It's not surprising.
It's not a lot of stories when you think about it. 52. They must get thousands of submissions, and they select 52
absolutely.
A year.
Yeah,
that's not a lot. Now, I guess, because I'm a lot older than you are, and I remember the general weekly magazines like Saturday Evening Post and Collier's, and they had several short stories every issue, and writers could really make a living. I was talking to Kurt Vonnegut, who was working at that time in the late 1940s, early 1950s for General Electric. And he sold a short story, I believe, to the Saturday Evening Post for something like $3,000 or $4,000. And then he sold another one. And with the second sale, he had earned more money from two short stories than he made a year from GE as a writer in the public relations department. Mm-hmm. So he quit his job and began writing short stories. Unfortunately for Kurt, a couple of years later, the bottom dropped out of the short story market. But by that time, he was selling his novels, so it worked out. But it really is not possible, I would guess, for a writer to earn a living selling short stories today.
No, not the way it was. I mean, no, not selling short stories. If you think about that, $3,000 or $4,000 probably went a lot further in the late '40s than it does today. John Cheever lived, I think, rather well as a short story writer. Primarily, I've read things about his life. There were lots of people doing it then. And no, the literary magazines pay very little for a short story, maybe $100 for a short story in a literary magazine.
Or give you some free copies.
Right. And what you get is recognition. Most writers now have to teach in universities because it's the way that we support ourselves. And it's a very odd thing to be going on, to have all the people in the country who are recording what life is like now doing this really odd thing, which is academic world is not the same as the rest of the world. It would be nice if we could go back to living from writing.
Yeah, it would be nice, but well, there are a few people. Malcolm Bossy does it. He actually does teach too. I come to think of it, he teaches at the graduate school of City University. But he has had some bestsellers like the mm-hmm. Warlord and a couple of movie sales and things. Well, let's talk about the Hooper family and how these characters evolved in your mind.
Now, that's a tough one. Now, I started writing the book with the last story, which is about the death of the father, Edward Hooper. I was just trying to write a story about my own father's death some years after it happened, and it seemed to me enough time had gone by that I should try to do it. But I found that the first couple of versions, which were really close to my own life, didn't work very well. And I finally gave the story to a narrator who was not me, who I'd already developed in another story, a young woman, and invented her family in that story. So the father in the story is not based on my father. He's based on other people I know. And that's true for everyone in the book. They're all based on people I know, sometimes two people, put together, but the real people don't know each other, and I made them into this family, and it's what worked for me. I think in the end I told the emotional truth about my own life, which is what I wanted to do, but it's not, the details are not the same as my own family.
I can certainly understand that. Edward Hooper is a college professor who was educated at Harvard and is, at the time of his death, teaching at Berkeley. So that's certainly not as your own family. And I would assume your mother was not a German immigrant.
No.
So, yes, I can certainly see. Mm-hmm. However, I don't think anybody can write inside of a dark closet. All the things that you have seen, have absorbed in your life somehow is exposed in your writing. And I was talking to Paul Monnett, who is a very, very fine writer, yesterday, and he has a new novel that has a whole cast of characters, and he was saying that every one of the characters is in part himself, even the good ones
true.
Or the bad ones.
Yeah, no, that's always true. Yeah, I think that's one of the reasons why I was better able to write it with these more invented characters, because I could inhabit all of them in a way that I can't really inhabit members of my family. Every character in this book is in some sense me, and I do tell stories from their point of view, from most of the points of view in the family, including a first-person story from the father's point of view, which is the first one in the book. He's 6'4", and I mean, he's a college professor like me, so I feel identified with him that way, but he's a man, and he's tall, and he died in 1970, and you know, he was a soldier in World War II, and but there are real points of contact between him and my father too, who also went to Harvard for graduate school and was also fought in World War II and so on.
And the children, tell me, let's see, there are two brothers and
three sons and a daughter.
Yeah,
right.
Tell me about them.
Well, they're all one of them's partly based on my own brother. I have one brother,
not the revolutionary.
No, Hank is the one I feel the closest to of the characters in the book, and it's funny to say that because he he isn't one of the major characters in the book. He's kind of peripheral. And that's probably because I feel so close to him. Yeah.
But he's extremely colorful. He's probably the most colorful of all the kids.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you're probably right about that. Yeah. Though David, I like the most. David, the one who goes to Vietnam. He's a very gentle character. I like.
David goes to Vietnam. Hank goes to Cuba.
Right. That's right.
And I like the little girl. There's a very touching story about the cat.
Mm-hmm.
That was so nice. And I think the personality of the cat was captured so well.
He's in there as himself. Seymour the cat is a real cat. His name is Seymour. And you know, he adopted me the year we lived in Berkeley. So you see who I am in that story. I'm not the little girl. I'm the one being adopted by the cat who moves across the street. He's exactly like that, Seymour. A wonderful cat. And that story is going to be in an anthology of cat stories, which will benefit animal rights groups called The Company of Cats.
Oh, so you are a cat lover, huh?
Yes, I love them intensely, but I'm allergic to them, so I can't own my own.
Is that right?
But they adopt me everywhere I go.
Yeah. Well, cats usually are very good judges of character. It's interesting that the family, these stories of this family are so moving, and yet nothing really spectacular happens to them. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're not kidnapped on an airliner. They're not shipwrecked at sea. They're not lost in the woods or consumed by earthquakes. You know, they're in many respects they're like a very conventional family, aren't they?
Mm. Yes, absolutely. Except that the mother is a refugee from Nazi Germany. Her sister was a Nazi and married an officer in the SS. And she married an American soldier and came home with him. They're typical and extraordinary too, I think, in many ways. And of course, the children's generation, one son becomes an executive in an oil company, one goes to Vietnam, and one is a campus radical who has to go underground. Besides the daughter, who's only 17 at the end, they sort of represent their time, I suppose.
I like the mother a lot, actually. I have a sister-in-law who's German, and she is kind of like the mother in the book, except my sister-in-law saw the light. God came to her on an airplane from Houston to Atlanta. And she has converted to a very deep feeling toward Christianity, which sets her apart from most members of my family. But she has that same sort of meticulous approach to things that the mother, I can't remember her name.
Ella,
yes, has. She's vivid enough that I can see her walking around the streets of Berkeley with her camera.
Mm.
Another thing I liked too, it was the house was interesting with the deck in the back. I don't think I had pictured a house quite like that before.
But ever? You hadn't thought about a house?
I don't think so. Yeah. I'm not used to hills.
Yes. They live on a very steep hill. It's 2,000 feet above sea level, but it goes all the way down to the bay in San Francisco. So it's a spectacular view from the top of that hill, and they live up near the top of it. Though in the second story. In the first story that's set in Berkeley, they're not living in that house yet, and that's something I'm not sure I made totally clear in the book. They're in a little rented cottage in the first time we see them in Berkeley, but then later they move up the hill to this house that has a deck looking out over San Francisco Bay and the city and everything.
Well, what's going to happen with the Hooper family? Because the father has died at the end, but the rest of the family members have survived. Are we going to see more of them in the future?
You definitely are. I've written five more stories about the Hoopers that go all the way up into the present, all the way up to the present. I started dealing with some of them in another novel, which I stopped partway into. It's about Hank and Laura, who was the father's lover. And Hank, who was his third son, who was a campus radical, in the 1980s, they are close friends and living near each other on a rundown street in Berkeley. And the story is told from the point of view of the baby. There's a baby in one story named Simone de Beauvoir, and she's 2 months old or something in that story, and she's 17 in this other novel, and she's telling the story. And that gives you the update on all the Hoopers. Maybe someday I'll finish that one.
Well, while you can go forward in time, you can also go backward, can't you? In fact, I believe you just said that the story started with the final story in the, in the novel.
That's right.
And so it, you know, it's kind of interesting. I was reading Joan Didion's novel. I can't remember the title of it offhand. But here was a novel that was so, it was set in Latin America. And it was so completely out of chronology that it skipped back and forth. And at first it was a little confusing, but by the time you finished the novel, the whole period was reconstructed in your mind so that you knew exactly what happened. It didn't have to be chronological at all.
Mm-hmm. Was that the Book of Common Prayer by Joan Didion?
No. I wish I could remember the title of that one. It's a very thin book, and I remember the characters vividly, and I can't remember the title. I can find it later. But isn't that interesting that while we live chronological lives, bits and pieces of things happen to us, actually. And I'm talking to you 1 minute, and then I'll have to go and grab a bite to eat another minute, and then I'll talk to somebody else, and then I'm making an appointment for next week. And then, you know, so it's kind of confusing as we go on when you think about it, if you try to orient our lives. But at the end of the week, you can look back and say, hey, I've done this, right? And you can do that in a book.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter. You could have put that last chapter perhaps at the beginning if you wanted to.
Absolutely. And I read that one when I give readings, and I tell people that it's all right. This is the end of the book, but you can start anywhere in this book and read it in any order. That is something like the way we live, as you were just saying. And not only are we doing all these different things in a day, we're also remembering things all the time, so that our experience is not totally chronological. Things come back to us, and we relive them vividly in an ordinary day.
Yeah. Isn't it interesting and very self-fulfilling, too, to create this world of people?
That'd
you know, your
wonderful.
Own world, and you can populate it any way you want, and you know, and it springs from your own imagination. It's really extraordinary, isn't it?
It was wonderful. I miss the Hoopers and would like to go back to them. Right at the moment, I have to prove I can write outside of the Hooper world, so I'm writing about something else now. But I love being with them and thinking about them. And it feels wonderful to make something out of nothing.
Yeah, a lot of the writers I've talked to, in effect, fall in love with their characters.
Mm.
And some of them have told me they have gone into feelings of depression at the end of a book. They didn't want to leave them.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Because they seem to be so real. I was reading Peter Ackroyd's biography of Dickens, a huge biography of Dickens. Dickens was so captivated by his characters that he would act them out. So he would be sitting in his study, or sometimes standing before a mirror, and he would be talking like Scrooge, and he would wave his arms, and he would mimic them, and his face would grimace, and he took their parts. He felt so strongly about his characters, and he almost lived them. I don't assume that most writers go quite that far, but still, I think you carry them around with you. What would Hank do next? What's Ella up to now? What about Laura? Is she going to deal with bulimia or whatever?
You do one at a time. I mean, I wouldn't do them all that fast. I'm one character for the amount of time I'm working on a story, which might be 2 months, might be three or four longer. And so I'm very intensely living that person in my mind and thinking about him or her all the time.
Where are you teaching?
Indiana University in Bloomington.
That's the home of the bicyclist?
That's right. Yes, the race is next weekend.
Well, what's it like? Is your husband also teaching there?
No, he teaches at Loyola University in Chicago. He's a poet. And I live mainly in Chicago and commute down to Bloomington just to teach briefly and go back up to Chicago.
How do you teach briefly?
I teach on Monday and Tuesday. And then I go home.
So what do? Go down on Sunday nights or what?
Right.
Was it, did you drive, right.
drive down? I used to fly, but the airfare's doubled, so I've been driving this year.
And you're teaching what, English?
English and creative writing. I have a giant lecture class of 250 students that I talk to. It's called Introduction to Creative Writing, and I lecture them once a week on something like character or plot or dialogue.
250 students? Well, you don't have to read their manuscripts.
No, I have 8 teaching assistants who do that.
Are you head of the department or what?
No, no, that's the way things are done at the giant universities. I'm just an ordinary associate professor.
Well, you're not an ordinary associate professor. You're an extraordinary associate professor. But 250 students, gosh, there must be a lot of interest in creative writing now.
I'm not sure that's true, but they are in the class. Yeah, they are in the class. There is actually a lot of interest in creative writing. Universities all over the country have started MFA programs, Master of Fine Arts programs, of which we have one. And it's part of this movement toward writers writing in their spare time and teaching in colleges to support themselves, which is we talked about earlier. And to do that, many young writers now go into Master of Fine Arts programs and get a degree in creative writing that will also qualify them to teach in a college. I didn't do that. I got a PhD in English and did scholarly work.
Yeah. I would assume, I took some creative writing courses when I was in college, although I was a journalism major. But I would assume that even if someone who studies creative writing in college doesn't actually apply it as a living, that the study of it is very helpful, because it would seem to me it would make a person think more about words and people and things. I mean, for example, I'm not saying you can't be a chemist and do that, but I have a feeling that people who are in chemistry don't think quite the way a writer would think in terms of analyzing people and... Does this make sense at all?
It makes a little sense, but it worries me that people now are going to school to learn how to write. This is a new thing. It's not more than 30 years old, I don't think. There might have been... the Iowa Writers' Workshop might have been around before that, but it used to be that people learned how to write by reading, which is in fact how I learned, by reading and figuring out, just really not even having to think about it, just absorbing a lot of great writing. I've read most of English and American literature, and that's how I learned how to write. And I don't think you can teach people how to write in the classroom. I mean, I'm speaking as someone who does it for a living. It's an odd thing to try to teach people, and to sit around talking about writing is very helpful to a point for young writers, but really the main thing is they have to spend a lot of time reading, and a chemist could do that, though he might be quite distracted by chemistry.
I hated chemistry. God, I didn't have to take it in college. I don't think I could have passed it. It took me 2 runs to pass chemistry in high school, as it was. I was terrible, terrible.
I did quite well in chemistry, actually.
You loved it?
Yeah.
Really?
Got an A.
Rub it in. This is a beautiful book. By the way, Nixon, you're not related to the Nixons.
No, I don't think so.
This is your first novel. How does it feel? This new book just out, and you... able to hold it in your hands and see your characters almost come to life in these pages? How does it feel to you?
It feels great. People are being so kind to me. I'm getting so much attention from all over the country.
It'll pass.
It's great.
Enjoy it. Well, it happens. It's like the people who win Pulitzers and other prizes. You know, there's a lot of flurry of activity. They give interviews and photographers come around. And then a couple of weeks later... they get back to normal, you know, and people forget about it. And they have to remind people, I'm a Pulitzer Prize winning poet. Well, this is certainly a beautiful book, and when Little Brown called to say that you were going to be in town, I was very happy to know that and to invite you here to talk about your work, and it's a beautiful book. Cornelia Nixon, thank you very much.
Well, thank you.